to Dialogue Across Difference, an event series hosted by the Center for the Study of Politics and Governance at the University of Minnesota's Humphrey School of Public Affairs. Join us as Center Director Larry Jacobs and guests engage in conversations across the political and policy spectrum on issues of the day.
Welcome to this event, this panel discussion about the Trump inauguration and America's failure. We're following fast on today's events with the departure of Joe Biden and the inauguration of Donald Trump as America's 47th president. I'm Desmond King, based at the University of Oxford, and I'm co-moderating this with Professor Lawrence Jacobs from University of Minnesota's Hubert Humphrey School of Public Affairs. We have a stellar lineup of four panelists to discuss the statements today and what the prospects are for the future. And they're being shown to you now, and we will introduce them individually as they speak. Wanted to highlight what I took as several takeaways from the speech today and how these might be significant for the next 4 years compared with the period when Trump was the 45th president. I'm sure others will add their own views about this, but there was a huge stress on mandate and his success in the swing states. And his multiracial electorate, he said, quote, "I have a mandate to reverse a betrayal of the American people, and American people have spoken." Even though we know the popular vote was actually not that large, it was 49.9% for Trump compared to 48.3% for Nixon. He imputed an extraordinary scale of failure to the outgoing administration, belittling its control by what he calls the radical and corrupt establishment, which will be replaced. There was a revival, novelty of the term manifest destiny, which is going to make a lot of scholars and colleagues uncomfortable, since this is not usually a term celebrated without taking account of what was involved in the destruction under manifest destiny. And there was promises on the basis of this to take back Panama and to get to Mars. A string of executive orders were promised, covering many areas which we will talk about in our discussion on the panel, including deportations and ending diversity targets in employment. And there was a striking declaration in terms of free speech and against censorship by the government, which again, I think we'll pick up on later. And then finally, I think what was very striking, and again, colleagues will take up different views, is who the audience was. And it was behind him, the tech oligarchs with whom he's built this this base very fast and very quickly. I saw certainly the owner of the Washington Post and the owner of SpaceX very close by. So that I think signaled something to us about what's going to happen in the next few years. And many scholars have written about this recently. I think it'll be very important. So welcome to this debate. I'll pass you now to Lawrence Jacobs, who's co-moderating, and we'll go into some of the logistics and introduce our first speaker.
Great. Thank you very much, Professor King. Just a quick reminder or alert to folks who are joining us. You'll see at the bottom of the screen, there's a Q&A button. That's your opportunity to participate. Please give us questions, challenging questions, and we're going to get to as many as possible. You'll see next to it, there's a show captions. If you need that feature, please click on that. We're going to now start the program. And what we're going to do is we're going to go from each of our panelists. We're going to allow them to make a presentation. We'll have a few opening questions. And once we've gone through allowing each panelist to speak, Professor King and I will moderate a conversation amongst the full panel, and then we're going to open it up for your questions. So again, please give us some terrific questions. Mr. Tom Edsall, thank you so much for joining us. When you think of the inaugural address and what you expect to be coming, what do you think will be the most disruptive and most consequential as we head into Donald Trump's second presidency?
Well, I think actually he didn't talk about the two things that I think will be very significant. It's hard to say which will be most significant, but he didn't talk about specifically about Schedule F, where he would politicize the senior levels of the civil service, all the civil servants who are involved in making and regulating policy, enforcing the laws. It's about 50,000 people that are the cream of the crop would become subject to firing, and they will lose their basically their tenure rights or their workplace protection rights. This is a radical innovation, and he has promised to do that, and I expect he will, but he didn't talk about it. The second thing he didn't talk that much about were is his revenge policies. He is committed on the campaign stump and rhetorically to basically trying to jail and imprison and use the regulatory apparatus against those who have been his adversaries and enemies politically and on policy, both within his party and outside of his party. I think he has been told that this is not a great selling point, and he better not use that as part of his inaugural speech. But I think both of those are there laying in the background. And the speech itself struck me as an effort on Trump's part to create a reality to justify his attempts to really alter the course of government. He portrayed the Biden administration in the past 4 years as terrible, horrible years, when in fact the economy that he is inheriting from Biden is exceptionally healthy. Inflation is down, unemployment is down. He in fact is the beneficiary of a and will profit from a very good economy that basically Biden never got credit for because of the issue of inflation trumped the gains that Biden had made. But Trump is portraying that in entirely negative sort of American carnage kind of imagery. And that is so he can set the stage where he will introduce his tariffs, for example. His immigration policies, he was very strong on the immigration policies. He was very strong on stressing gender identity issues. He's very much opposed to transgender rights, and he is very assertive in the view that there are two sexes, men and women, and there ain't anything in between. This was one of the main themes of his campaign, and he is continuing to use that. There was a strong element of pushing the culture war issues that have mobilized the Republican and MAGA base hard. The immigration issue, in addition to declaring basically that the country is suffering an invasion, further justifying his use of the armed forces to protect the country from it, from this invasion of criminals and violent immigrants. Again, all of that depends on portraying a country that is in horrible shape. And under existing under terrible conditions. This was, I think, his central theme through this, and how this will play out, we will see. He is certainly not holding back, and I think we are in for a hell of a 4 years to come. Let me leave it at that.
Great. Thank you so much, Mr. Edsel. If you think back to Trump's first term in office, there was a lot that he tried to do and had some success. There was a lot that didn't pass. He wanted to repeal the Affordable Care Act, didn't happen. He obviously made a big deal about the wall. 52 miles of it were built, but not the, the other 2,000 miles. His policies and laws were rejected by the Supreme Court at a kind of a record rate among modern presidents. So I'm curious, how should we think about the capacity of those in government and those outside to resist and to delay and perhaps defeat?
I think the constraints on Trump this time around are much weaker. We don't know what the Supreme Court will do, but it certainly is a Supreme Court that is far more sympathetic to Trump than the Supreme Court was when he first took office in 2017. He's got majorities in both the House and Senate, and the Republican Party has basically become a Trump party. So he does not have the congressional constraints in terms of the majorities that exist now in the House and the Senate. He also has going with the, Ezra Klein had a very good column yesterday where there are an accumulation of forces that are giving Trump momentum and his alignment with these tech oligarchs. Actually changes Trump from a candidate who was campaigning on the past, which is the Make America Great Again, to a candidate who is aligned with those who look towards the future, toward the people who are the innovators, the people who are going forward. Even his cryptocurrency stuff, as screwy as it may be, is still to a lot of people, a forward-looking thing, a new thing, not a look in the past. So he is a, it's a, I think Trump is significantly more formidable. But the main thing is that this time around, all his supporters knew that he was a chaotic, disordered man who could not really administer the government. This time, they know that's one of his weaknesses, and they have created a whole universe of people to be appointed to key posts throughout government to keep him on track. And if he gets control of the civil service, which this Schedule F may do, he will really be empowered in a much stronger fashion than in 2017. And basically, his. It's like the guardrails may have been just giving him just a 2 foot wide avenue this time around. It's like it's the width of Pennsylvania Avenue, right down to the Capitol, where he just basically, and all the executive branch agencies along Pennsylvania Avenue, all of them now under his direction will be much more supportive and helping give him a momentum and a drive. He is a savvy politician, and he has capitalized on this extremely well at creating an atmosphere that is much more. It's not as if he had barely won the presidency. There's this tone that Republicans and Trump have swept Washington, and what. It may not be realistic, but that's what he's got going for him at this moment. And the perception is in politics is as or more important as the reality. And in this case, he has really made great use of the perception.
Thank you very much, Mr. Edsel. Professor King?
Good. Let me turn. I really agree with that term, swept Washington. And I want to say that, especially with the rally last night, and then the way the inauguration has gone today. We're going to turn now to Professor May Knive, a historian at Columbia University, probably America's most important historian of immigration policies, whose book Impossible Subjects I recommend to everybody amongst her various writings. May, if we can come to you, I think we're desperate for historical perspective on this proposed systematic deportation, closing of the border, the extent to which it's legally possible, even logistically possible. What the In his inauguration speech today, as we know, he invoked the 1798 Alien Enemies Act, which is going back a long time in history, but that's presidents often do this. How do you take assessment of where we are?
Right. Well, first, thank you, Professor Jacobs and Professor King, for having me today. I will say that were it not for this program, I may not have tuned into the inauguration speech, but nonetheless, let me make a few general comments first, which I think
Yes,
might
ma'am.
help frame my views on the immigration question. First, we don't know what he will do or what he can do. We don't know. But I think he will do four things for sure: cut taxes for the wealthy, further deregulate business. Those are standard conservative measures. And the two other things that he will use the government to go after his enemies, his opponents, and he will pardon the January 6th insurrectionists. And those two last things, I think, index Trump's obsession with his personal power above all else. And these are the hallmarks of an authoritarian and the destruction of democratic norms that is required by it. Now, actually, I don't think Trump cares that much about policy. I don't think he's that interested in governing, but he has appointed people who are very interested in policies, people like Stephen Miller, people like RFK Jr. And I don't think it's clear what they can accomplish with a very narrow majority in the Congress. And so I think it remains to be seen how far he can go with some of these ideas. Schedule F is very scary. I agree with Tom on that. How deep they can go is, I think, it remains an open question. Maybe the best case scenario is that he goes and plays golf and works on his grift while his appointees work on their own grift and fall over each other in their incompetence. That would be the best case scenario. But unfortunately, I think it will be messier than that. Even with modest implementations, there will be great harm done to many people. If they eliminate mandatory vaccines on children, we'll definitely see a reintroduction of diseases that have long since been gone, like polio. And even if he does not do a full-scale mass deportation, millions of people will be harmed minimally by being frightened and terrorized. So let me talk about immigration. I think it's instructive that it's the top item that he talks about in his speech today, the top policy item. And I think there's a reason for that. I'm going to talk a little bit about the questions you asked, Des, about what can he do, what are the legal possibilities, the logistic questions. But I'm going to talk about also why immigration is so important to him. Why is it his number one issue? I think that's something we have to think about, and it has a lot to do with not just his style of politics, but where this country's politics and political divisions are going. So, first of all, I think if you've been paying attention to immigration over the last several weeks, you'll notice a little bit of a mixed signal. On the one hand, they talk about we're going to go after the criminals, we're going to go after the people who already have orders of deportation. And that's that you get a lot of buy-in, because who wants, you always go after the criminals first. But then if you look at what they've been doing, Thursday they did a big sweep near Bakersfield, California, They were raiding farms. They were raiding, sweeping up people in Walmart parking lots. This is not just going after people who have standing warrants, right? They've planned for tomorrow a big sweep of Chicago, a shock and awe campaign. Holman has said he doesn't care about separating families. So you have this rhetoric at one level about criminals, and today he repeated the lies he's been telling for a long time about millions and millions of criminal aliens, right? And people sent from prisons and mental institutions into the United States, right? That is the picture he wants to paint. So, what would it take to deport 11 million undocumented people? The American Immigration Council estimates a one-time effort would cost $315 billion. And I think maybe the biggest constraint would be that it would require hiring 200 to 400,000 government employees to effectuate it. Or maybe he'll just call on the army. Okay, that's one scenario. If he deports 1 million people a year over for 10 years, that will cost $88 billion a year, require building 200 detention camps with tents, and hiring 30,000 new ICE officers. Now, the human cost of mass deportations obviously is immeasurable, right? A majority of undocumented people in this country have been here for more than 10 years. 4 million are part of mixed status families. That is, they have a spouse or children who are American citizens. The social cost, widespread disruption, fear in many communities, cities, and states. The economic cost, in addition to the cost of actually deporting people, it would be horrific. Immigrants are the mainstay of construction, agriculture, the hospitality industries. They pay close to $80 billion a year in taxes. The loss of immigrant workers and their purchasing power also would mean a loss of 4.2% or more of our GDP, and that's how much we lost during the recession of 2007. Now, I want to refer to Operation Wetback, which Trump has talked about repeatedly as his model, right? Under Eisenhower, they deported 1 million Mexicans. They did. They deported 1 million people in 1954. But what he doesn't tell you is that in the immediate years following, apprehensions went down dramatically to as low as 50,000, 40,000, 20,000. And here's the important thing. The government allowed growers to h directly hire undocumented migrants into the bracero program, the guest worker program. And this is something that they're already talking about. I am led to believe that this is something the Department of Agriculture is already planning for, and this would be a cynical way to avoid increases in food prices, which would no doubt happen if they deported all the farm workers, by putting migrant workers into indentured servitude. That's what it amounts to. So, why is this issue the number one issue in Trump's agenda? And I want to say that what he said today, it's actually really telling that he's going to send the army to the border. In order to do that legally, he has to say there's an invasion. And this is why he said he's going to declare the Mexican cartels as terrorists. If they're declared terrorists, then he can send the army,
Right.
right? And then he can use the Alien and Enemies Act. There has to be an actual invasion. So this is how he's going to try to work around that. But why is this his most important issue, right? Immigration in the past has never been the top issue in the electorate. When people actually go to the polls, they never vote immigration first. This is the first time that people did, both Democrats and Republicans. And I think it's because, Trump figured out in 2016 that the way to get white working class voters was through anti-immigration politics. This was Bannon and Miller's strategy, and it worked. And this is the classic nativist playbook. You appeal to a section of the population that has grievances, economic grievances. You create a theory of difference and blame those people for it, and then you weaponize it for partisan gain. And I think that, and what fuels this is the right-wing media ecosphere, where and the MAGA culture, in which Trump is a celebrity. He's a reality TV star, and he can say anything. He can say Mexico's sending rapists, they're eating the pets. He can say anything. And Pete, this is what people want to hear. So I think a lot of this is geared at one level to harm immigrants, for sure, but a lot of it is to keep his base motivated, to keep his base active and motivated. So I'll say one more thing and then I'll shut up.
Good. No, thank you.
Yes.
Keep going.
Okay. So, in 2017, immigrant rights groups and immigrant groups were ready. When the Muslim ban dropped, thousands of people showed up at JFK, at LAX, right? Churches and community groups were doing trainings, know your rights, do not open the door, do not speak to anybody. In the agricultural areas, there were warning systems through texting. In the meat packing plants, the unions trained workers and employers to not let ICE in their factories unless they had warrants. So these things are going on now. People are being prepared. So there will be resistance. But what I worry about is who is going to support the immigrants? Mayor Adams in New York has already said he's going to cooperate with ICE, even though New York is a sanctuary city. And we all know he wants to stay out of jail. That's why he's doing that. My university, I'm sorry to say, is reluctant to publicly say now that they will support our DACA students, our undocumented students, something they said in 2017. And these are all signs of surrender in advance. This is part of a general trend where our institutions are caving into authoritarianism in advance, right? The Republican Party, the tech industries, especially those involved in social media platforms, the mainstream media, the universities, these are institutions of democracy, and they already are caving in to the destruction of democracy. So I think this is very worrisome. And I don't know how it's going to go. I don't think any of us can say how it's going to go. I think that there's a potential for it not going that well for Trump, but there's also a potential for an acceleration of authoritarianism. And when the LA fires were burning last week, I thought about climate change as something that is accelerating. Right, we have an acceleration in the increase of the frequency and ferocity of fires and hurricanes that are besetting this country and, of course, around the world. And I think an acceleration in right-wing politics and governance is also a possibility. It could be our new normal, but we don't know. We're going to have to fight it out.
Professor Nye, thank you so much for the really thoughtful and helpful comments on this. This is a good moment, I think, to move to Professor Nadia Urbanati, who's joining us also from Columbia University and who's a distinguished political theorist and has thought about I think I'm fair in saying has thought about a lot of the normative implications along the lines of what May Nye has been suggesting about the authoritarian shift. Thank you very much for joining us.
Professor Urbanati, thank you so much for joining us. Let me ask what I asked Tom Edsel to you. What did you find to be the most disruptive or consequential aspect of Donald Trump's inaugural address today?
Well, first of all, thank you for having me here in this conversation, which for me it is an opportunity to reflect more about what I heard today, but also what I heard in the past 2 months. So it seems to me that, to begin, I would like to simply propose a few issues for discussion. The first issue is precisely connected to today's inauguration. I compare this inauguration with the former one by Trump in 2017, the same day, January the 20th, The difference is enormous. But not only for what he said, because it's almost the same. The style is populist, the attack against the establishment is the same. There are many tropes that are the same. But the atmosphere, the political mentality and atmosphere is very different. I remember the big demonstrations in 2017 in Washington. There were two Americans over there. The first one, the Trump one, and the second one, the anti-Trump one. Well, this year, perhaps because of the cold, but I don't think that is a question of temperature, the mentality has been changed, in my view. Not because people are not, or many Americans are not against Trump, but because the mental disposition toward Trump has changed. And in two ways. First, there is a kind of acceptance of a situation that is truly going toward authoritarian regimes. It is as if the opposition doesn't have the strength enough to stop it and the strength enough to find an alternative way to what Trump proposed us all. Trump proposed us something, and here I come to the second issue, which was already widely discussed in our conversation, but I want to approach it from a different perspective. Trump used, again, not only in the first term, but also in the second one, the myth of immigration. I call it a myth on purpose. Myth in the tradition of coming from Georges Sorel, coming from Ernesto Laclau. It means an empty concept capable of being interpreted by anybody or everybody according to the problem we have. So it's an empty concept in which poor people, ordinary people, middle class, high class people, they put their own desire, preoccupations, and opportunity for their own life. It is an empty word that can be used easily in order to make sure that you have a large background or a large support. And indeed, in one of the last survey by Ipsos and the New York Times, it seems that half of the Democrats believe that immigration is a strong problem and is a big problem to be approached not simply with the containment of new immigrants, but also expulsion of existing immigrants in the States. So the Trumpism is making a fortune among Democrats. And this is what should worry us because it means that the opposition doesn't have a weaponry capable of autonomously resisting this wave of authoritarianism. So this is immigration. I spoke with also colleagues of mine. The idea that Trump proposed has been accepted by many, namely that the immigration, illegal immigrations, is a way of keeping the salaries down and making an unfair competition between American workers and black kind of unregulated work, which means that there is an unfair retribution in terms of salary, and this unfairness is paid by Americans and while the immigrants, illegal immigrants, they grow. So there is this sense of injustice in a state incapable of protecting its own citizens, and this made its way through the Democrats through. So this is one issue, the issue of the immigration. The second issue that, according to me, is relevant, it is a question of the oligarchs. Now, if you put your finger over Trump, I'm sorry, over Musk, well, you can see today in the inauguration in the Rotunda, the position, physical position, the space position by the oligarchs, the Silicon Valley people, was closer to Trump than the members of his cabinet. So this non-elected yet powerful class sharing in one at least sharing together one at least one goal, that of using the state for prompting their own interests through the globe, this tells us that this is a kind of authoritarianism, not equal to other previous ones, but directly maneuvered by a class of people moved by, stimulated by their own interests. And thus the state has been, is, can be captured easily with Trump by this class. And I hope I speak about class because this is a true class. Second element that within this class or within this role by Musk impressed me a lot is its fascist linguistic use. He uses a language that is truly fascist. When Musk speaks about the German politics or the German new elections that we are going to have in more, almost 1 month, he's speaking about a country that the American Republic contributed in liberating from fascism and Nazism, and it cost a lot of life, American lives. And yet he goes to Berlin through his acts, of course, he goes symbolically to Berlin and asks now, I'm talking about Musk, that the right wing should rule Germany. And not only Germany, and not only rule, but not only the right wing, but a specific one, the most radical one, that one that has connections, historical connections with anti-Semitism, with the hierarchical conception of society, with a nativist, a strong nativist conception of the nation, and strongly anti-egalitarian. So I'm very worried that at least in Europe, particularly in Europe, this new second Trump will have an impact that is even bigger than the first one, the first Trump. First of all, because of these electoral times that is very unfortunate for the Democrats in Germany, but also in France. And we already saw Austria going toward the right wing, a strong right wing. So in my view, this is an issue that is connected to the new administration. The third and final issue, and then I want to close here, is the anti-European project that Trump and his people, I mean, in this case, the Musk people, they have. When I say against Europe, I mean against European Union, against the regulatory politics that the European Union has been using since the 90s in order to contain the power of big capitals and particular great corporations, and in order to induce, impose on them to pay taxes and impose on them to constrain and control their social, and in the name of freedom, in the name of liberty, this kind of radical negative freedom, Musk and Trump never denied, so I presume he accepted this idea of Musk, he's attacking strongly the European Union. And this, in my view, is something very new. First of all, because for the first time after World War II, certainly, the West is divided and the U.S. is not longer such a friendly supporter of the European democracy, can be an enemy of the European to the European democracy. So I think that the Trump, who presents himself as the representative of the West today, he used this expression, not also yesterday, he has in fact he's in fact opening the floor, the door to a division within the West that it can be very dramatic, not only because of his politics of demoting the NATO and taking away support from the NATO, but also because he clearly has a plan that has to do with this protectionism, that has to do with making America great again against all other countries, against all other countries, West and East, China and Europe. So I think these new authoritarian America or new authoritarian government administration should be analyzed from the point of view of the whole spectrum politics, not only domestic but international, and not only military international but also economic international, and in particularly the question of anti-regulatory conception of liberalism they have and capitalism they have, which is bad for US and is also bad for outside of the US. I mean, Latin American perhaps, and America and Europe. Remember that he had only two guests from abroad in the inauguration day, Milei and Meloni. That is the two most neoliberal right-wing authoritarian leaders that we have on in the West. So I stop here, and I would like to have the chance to discuss about also these issues. Thank you.
Thank you very much,
Thank you.
Professor Urbanati. I want to move to our next panelist, Jacob Hacker, who's a professor of political science at Yale. And Professor Hacker is a prolific and influential author, including Winner Take All Politics and his most recent book, Can Democrats Win? Professor King will moderate this part of our discussion.
Yeah, thanks very much, Professor Hacker, for joining us. And your book, Winner Takes All, has been enormously influential. I'd let you pick the agenda that you're interested in, but if possible, could we talk a little bit about the practicalities of governing? And this has come up a few times already, and I think a lot of scholars have taken the view that it will be hard to get a lot of legislation through, that the courts may actually again challenge some of the executive orders and so forth. It seems to me it's possible to take quite a different view that there's a that there's and it was quite striking in the inauguration speech how he referred to sort of his team being the Supreme Court, Mike Johnson, and John Thune in the Senate, as if these are the people who'll be doing it for me, and you know they're all in positions of dominance within their particular institutions. And from that, I took a view that governing is, I mean, it's going to be messy, and I agree with colleagues who say that his attention span to policy is short, but the people below him, the people in the offices, are very, very focused.
Well, first, it's a real pleasure to be here. Thank you so much. And at this point in any event, I'm always reminded of a quote from the late Congressman, Arizona Democrat Mo Udall, who was fond of saying, "Everything has been said, but not everyone has said it." But I think I can say some new things. And Udall was like such a great quote meister. He also came up with one that I think is quite appropriate now. He said, "Let's turn inflation over to the post office. That'll slow it down." And another one, which is maybe some of us are thinking it, the voters have spoken, the bastards. So anyway, enough Udall quotes. So let me situate this a little bit, drawing on my work with Paul Pearson, and my most recent book is actually "Let Them Eat Tweets." The "Can the Democrats Win?" Piece behind me was a symposium in the Boston Review, and just to be clear, we made no such predictions. And I think if you looked at the performance of incumbent governments in rich democracies, the safest prediction you could have made in advance of this election was that the Democrats were going to lose. But I think what's really fundamental to thinking about this moment is basically the roots of that loss, and then what that implies, as you were saying, does about governance going forward. Because I think that journalists and pundits are often really focused on elections, and as Paul and I have tried to argue that that elections are fundamental to who holds power, but that it ultimately the question is how that power manifests itself in governance. That's what affects people's lives, and ultimately that's what can affect elections going forward, right? So if we're thinking about elections, we really need to think about, well, what is governance that we're going to see? What's its implications for elections? And so in Let Them Eat Tweets in 2020, Paul and I argued that this current coalition that has come back to power is best seen as a plutocratic populist coalition. So that resonates with Nadia's talk about the oligarchs, right? That it is a coalition that involves a right-wing populist set of themes that are very common to many rich democracies that have seen this insurgency. But that's coupled with a set of policies that May talked about, tax cuts for the affluent and corporations, deregulatory policies, an effort to backstop a very pro-business Supreme Court and to reduce the capacity of the administrative state to uphold previous policies like the Clean Air Act. That all of that is part and parcel of a kind of plutocratic policymaking regime, one that seems now to be moving from perhaps the more traditional plutocratic precincts of fossil fuels and finance into big tech, for example, and cryptocurrency, areas that were perhaps certainly with the case of big techs that were seen as being less allied with the Republican Party. And so I think we just cannot underestimate how important it is that we exist in a time of both unfettered money in politics and of the most affluent, most powerful billionaire class in the history of the universe. And that is a kind of force multiplier when it's aligned with Republican policy priorities. So I do think that leads us to think a little bit about governance because, if my read of the election is correct, that this was a really stark anti-incumbent moment, and that there are some really interesting stories that we should explore about, say, increasing Latino support for Trump, but that fundamentally we're talking about a kind of shift toward the Republican Party that was driven by widespread dissatisfaction with this particular moment, then there's a lot of people who have not signed up for the patterns of governance that we're soon going to see. If you know, mass deportations become the approach, if the kind of confrontational and divisive politics that was part that was so much a part of the first Trump presidency, if that takes center stage, there's going to be a lot of public backlash against this administration. But that doesn't mean that the governance will necessarily come unglued, because this is a coalition with unified control of government that has a few kind of very core interests that it's upholding and that has a very strong commitment to pursuing these policy goals. So my sense is that the weak link in Republican governance right now is the House of Representatives. Paul, my co-author, jokes that being Speaker of the House in the contemporary Republican Party is like being the defense of the dark arts teacher in Harry Potter, not a job that you want to have. And so Mike Johnson has handled things reasonably well, but there's this fundamental question of how he's going to deal with the right flank of his party and given very, very narrow margins. And the Republicans do need Congress and the House in particular to get through their large tax cuts, as well as some of the other major policy aims that they have. There is, though, I think, as your question implies, and as May's comments about policy suggest too, there is an asymmetry between the parties here, because I think a lot of what Republicans hope to do, what Donald Trump hopes to do, can be pursued without Congress, with a Supreme Court that's going to be, as Tom rightly said, much more willing to backstop the administration. Immigration policy, trade policy, these are areas of enormous executive authority. And then, of course, if you're pursuing deregulation, there is the sophisticated statutory approach to deregulation. Let's pass new laws. And then there's just rip it all up approach to deregulation, which is let's dismantle the administrative state. And that might well be the pursuit. Can be pursued without congressional authority as well. For me, there is an opportunity, and I hope we'll talk a bit more about the sort of current Democratic Party and how well it can seize this opportunity. But there is an opportunity in that earlier comment I had about the reality that there will be backlash, and the opportunity is, I think, going to be you know, is going to emerge relatively soon that we're going to start to see backlash, but the opportunity is most going to be most obvious in the midterm elections. And I could talk a lot about why the Senate is a much harder nut to crack for the Democratic Party than the House, but the House is barely in Republican hands now, and it could very well switch hands. And the question I think we all should ask is that kind of normal corrective mechanism enough given the authoritarian aspirations and capacities of the contemporary Republican Party?
I mean, one of the things that it strikes me is there's been a lot of inexperienced nominees to hold leading cabinet positions and other agency positions. My sense at the moment, it looks like almost all of these are going to get through the Senate next week. Those who need confirmation, and I mean, looking at this historically, people run into trouble pretty quickly. Presidents or prime ministers in Britain lose some of their nominees very quickly for incompetence or the usual scandals that emerge. So the question then is whether there's a different going to be a different level of competence below those senior positions. I mean, do cabinet officers matter in the American political system to the way in which this agenda is being thought through by such a pivotal people as Miller, who is going to be deputy policy director, I think, in the White House.
Yes, it's a great point and question. So I think that the people at the top, even if they lack governing experience and capacity, could nonetheless be very important. And maybe even the combination of very extreme people at the top and relatively capable people below them could have big implications for the way in which things play out. I mean, there's a tendency, I think, for analysts who are concerned about these trends to kind of hope for the most extreme manifestation of policy because they think that that's going to necessarily produce the kind of backlash. And I want to be careful not to succumb to that. A lot of people are going to get hurt by some of these policies if they're as extreme. Nonetheless, I do think that's where you're going to see the missteps and the backlash occur. It's going to be because a particular nominee, whether it's Tulsi Gabbard or RFK, or one of the others who really defy the historical practice of putting into cabinet offices somebody who has some experience and knowledge about the policies in question, that person makes just a major misstep or succumbs to a major scandal. And we just saw that. I mean, remember in the first Trump presidency, he talked about having the best, the very best people, and everyone, there was just a string of the best people who ended up in the news and not in a good way. And it was distracting, I think. And it's hard to get this ship of state to work if you're constantly besieged by negative public reactions, scandals, news. And so that could well play out, Des. But I sense in your question the same kind of ambivalence that I feel about it, because I do think there's going to be a lot of harm inflicted in the process. I also think there are a lot more capable, or at least more determined people who are going to be beneath the top level of executive power in this administration.
Can I jump in here on this?
Yes, please. Yeah.
I think we have to distinguish in different agencies. This will play out differently.
Yeah.
He wants Hegseth in defense because when he wants the army to go after civilian protesters, he doesn't want generals who are going to say, no, we can't do that. And he wants Bondi in justice so he can go after his perceived enemies. But the administrator, and then throughout, agency by agency, if they're going to tear up environmental laws, et cetera, they might do away with education. But the American state is a big ocean liner. It can't just turn on a dime. And it is, in some ways, a deep state, right? And there's millions of civil servants who do go to work every day on behalf of the American people. I don't know how much they can really destroy it. He can go after his political enemies, that's for sure. He's going to do that. He's going to deregulate more on behalf of business. There's a lot more that goes on in the federal government. And as far as this DOGE cutting back things goes, Let them go after Social Security. I mean, there's not that much discretionary in money in the budget that they can cut, right? I mean, there's very little for them to cut the amount that they want to cut. So I think it could be very ugly. And I know people who work in the government, members of my own family who work in the government, and they are concerned. But I don't know. I just think we have to distinguish at different ways that it might play out.
I think that's just, I want to just follow up on one point there, because I said earlier that I do think there's going to be real challenges in the House. And, to continue May's point about spending cuts, right, is that this is going to be tied up with the big tax cut bill. And there is one thing that's absolutely clear. Is that Americans did not sign up for massive spending reductions that hit them. There was a great piece in the New York Times was interviewing all these people who supported Trump, and they were asked, well, what about the policies that you're benefiting from? Some were on Medicaid, for example, and they were all just assumed and stated that, but of course they're going to cut something else, right? They're not going to go after that because that's really necessary. But if you start to talk about the kind of money that they think they're going to get out of cuts, it's just going to create enormous backlash. And this was really the hidden story of the healthcare reform debacle, not because everyone knows that it failed because there was so much in part because there was so much public concern about the cuts. But what they don't remember is that the reason that the Republicans were so insistent on cutting that much is they wanted to get rid of all the taxes that funded the Affordable Care Act. And so this sort of anti-tax stance has works pretty well if you don't pay for tax cuts, and that may be exactly where they end up. But if to the extent that they have to get a few of these hardcore Republicans on board with actual spending cuts, it is not going to go well, in terms of either the politics in the House or the politics among the American people.
Yes, and the debt ceiling issue has not gone, Jacob. And that
No, no. I
seems to be
mean,
very important.
I think we know how bad that could be. By the very fact that Donald Trump was trying to get them to get rid of the debt ceiling prior to taking office. No, this is a very valuable hostage that that the House Freedom Caucus is going to keep on taking. And again, I mean, I think we should not overstate the extent to which they need lawmaking to that Donald Trump needs lawmaking to do a lot of the things he wants to do. But for the coalition, it's really important that they get these big reconciliation bills, one or two, depending on where they end up, through. And that's just going to be a really tough fight. And it's going to be a fight that exposes a lot of the cleavages within the Republican coalition, which may not seem that deep right now in this moment of happy celebration, but are actually right beneath the surface.
Great. Thank you so much, Jacob. Professor Urbanati, I'm going to come to you. You've spent a career writing about the ways in which populism disfigures democracy, and the commentary, the media commentary, pretty broad commentary about Trump's official inaugural address had pleasing comments about what they saw as a toned-down approach, his reference to being a unifier, closing with "We are one people." What is the danger and the pattern that we've seen from populist leaders who claim to speak for the people and then use that power?
Beginning with his first term, Trump showed to have a not only a style but a mentality that is populist. And today we saw it again. First of all, the sense of unifying all the people. This is not something mild in relation to a populistic politics. It is a populistic politics. Which doesn't want disagreements, pluralism, conflict, opposition, doesn't like very much. A populist wants to have a homogeneous, not in terms of national, but in terms of political unification of the people, so that the leaders or the executive can easily operate according to this his or her plan. So there is thus this common trend in first Trump and second Trump. The other common trend in the two Trumps is, in my view at least, the dualism that is insist all the time between us and we the people, with more experience, perhaps, as he said today. I learned a lot from these in the last 8 years, with more experience, but the same people who are outside of the institutions versus the people inside of the institutions, the establishment, the deep state, even in my view, the military and the CIA, all these associations that are connected to a state that he regards as potentially an enemy of the people who express their own will. So there is this polarization between the two. And third element is the permanent looking for enemies. He's looking all the time for adversaries, not adversaries, because adversaries is a noble word, but with is looking for enemies, enemies inside, enemies outside. And he mobilizes all the forces, rhetorical forces, state-based forces, institutions that he can use it, the law, and above all, the propaganda. Thus, is in a permanent condition of electoral campaign. So you don't see the government governing. You see him using government for his campaign. And this is a problem because it destabilizes the sense of the independence of the institutions from the political actors using the institutions. So it gives the impression that the institutions should go back to the real owner. The real owner of the institutions is the people. That is, those who win the elections in the right way. He always stressed the fact that not all the majorities are the same. His majority is the most legitimate one because it is not the expression of a party, but it's the expression of the people that through him wants to reach Washington. So I think these tropes, that they seem to be simply rhetorical. They are not rhetorical, not all rhetorical at least, because they point to a conception of the states, a conception of the institutions, a conception of democracy that is dangerously oriented toward first, the centrality of the executive, second, the centrality of those who win, who are on the right side, and thus they want to unify the entire population or the entire nations in the name of their own will or desires or values. And finally, a permanent conspiracy or conspiratorial view so that he needs to create the sense that we are surrounded by enemy in order to justify a politics that is intolerant toward those who are considered to be enemies. As he said today, we cannot be tolerant against those who are the enemies. But who defines the enemies? Should we define the enemies from the point of view of an atavistic conception of the nation? Should we define the enemies people who are not born Americans? I became citizens 20 years ago. Should I be considered a potential enemy to this country because I'm not a native here on the state? So he makes us think in terms of doubts and potential enemies everywhere. And this is a way of destabilizing, not or disfiguring democracy, not strengthening it.
Could I just come in and Tom Edsel, ask you something, building on what you said earlier, and also building on the many terrific columns that you've written about what's going on with this electoral base? You pointed out, and I agree with you, that there's an atmosphere which has swept Washington at the moment that's pro-Trump, and the scale, although the scale of his electoral victory is something that doesn't necessarily impress election watchers, the sense of it as a big election victory is quite high. And what resource that does that give Trump as he governs? Will he continue to have rallies? Will he continue to draw on this electoral base in the way he did last night? The inaugural was not a rally speech, though it had elements of that, but the speech he gave afterwards in the Emancipation Hall certainly seemed like his standard approach. Your mute, your mic is on mute, sorry.
Sorry, can you hear me now?
Yes, thank you.
I think basically Trump has the advantage at this moment that Democrats seem to be conceding the f field to him, and he's got this sense that is actually conveyed to some degree in public opinion polling, where there's a lot stronger support for his policies than you might have expected. There's this quality, this sense, it's pe some people call it the vibes are with him, VIBES. The tone and tenor of Washington has tilted towards Trump at this moment. That gives him a lot more leeway or a lot more momentum to then push for his policies, because one, Republicans feel that they are now swept up in a movement, and two, Democrats feel that they don't really yet have a case to make against him, and they are kind of unsure and trying to find their way. When you're in that kind of fragile position, you're not much of an opposition. The result is that I think Trump, with this initial foray, which is going to, the next 100 days are going to be tons of actions by Trump. In this initial foray is going to be, it's going to be like throwing spaghetti on the wall. A lot of it's going to stick on the wall, and some may later get knocked down by the courts, or other institutions, but he will have the first step taken, and it will be hard for, even if in the case people try to appeal what he's done, that's a court process that will take time, and he is likely to be able to do what he wants to do without that much interference for the, it's hard to estimate this kind of thing, but probably for the first year. After the first year, it may be that by then the court process has caught up to what he has done. And even there, most of the action will be in federal courts, and he has got his own judges in throughout much of the federal court system, although Biden did appoint a lot of judges too. But the ultimate judge, a set of judges, is the Supreme Court. And there, Trump, it's really not clear how, whether they will put a brake on him or not. And where will they draw the line? It looks pretty vague at this point where that line will be, and it looks like it's going to be much more favorable to Trump than it might have been even 5 years ago.
Professor Nye, I want to ask you to respond to Tom Edsel's point that Trump is going to have plenty of running room for the courts to counter him. It's going to take time. They may not actually counter him. Congress is going to be divided, and it's going to be difficult to get Congress to act. Do you see that as creating a almost a just tremendous momentum for Trump on immigration issues? Particular.
Well, I do agree that he can start a lot of stuff, and even if people take it to court, those won't be settled quickly. I think that is a very good point that Tom made. I do think that with immigration, he has a lot of discretionary power. He doesn't need he needs Congress to give him money to carry out the big plans that he wants. But other than that, he does not need Congress to really authorize what he's threatening to do. I think it's questionable whether there will be backlash if he does mass deportations. I think a lot of people will support it. He's already primed the public that these are all criminals, and so people are not going to defend criminals, even though a lot of people who are going to be swept up are not criminals. But I think that, as Nadia said, this is the immigrants are the enemy. They are the permanent enemy. And he has used a very popular or very tried and true nativist playbook and wrapped it around this authoritarian populism. And so I think a lot of people are going to support it. And whether or not they support soldiers marching down the streets and hauling people away in trucks, I don't know, but I think they will support raids in communities, sweeps in the fields, people will support those things. I don't see any reason why there's going to be a backlash. And this is something different than 4 years ago when Trump separated children from their parents. That many people believe that was a big factor in the losses in the midterms elections, that a lot of the suburban women who were just appalled by ICE, the Border Patrol taking children from their parents. Those women voted for Trump this time. So, not all of them, but enough of them did. So I think that there is a difference now in how he has created a populist right-wing base in the United States. It's not so simple to say they're just all racist or they're all sexist. I mean, there is that. But I think that this idea of immigrants being the permanent enemy and we have to defend our country, we have to take our sovereignty back. I don't know that there's going to be enough backlash because you already have the Democrats have caved already on immigration. They're not opposing it. So I worry about that quite a bit. Even if he doesn't do, it's not easy to deport a million people a year, let alone 11 million. But he can deport enough and round up enough people that he can harm, do a lot of harm.
Professor Hacker, let me engage you on this theme. There are several questions here asking about the prospects of Democrats winning the House and eventually the Senate over the next 4 years. But as Professor Nye is saying, and also Tom Etzel, whether there's a backlash or not, that Donald Trump is certainly not a certainty. How do you size up kind of the institutional electoral dynamics here? Would you expect Donald Trump to be triggering a backlash that favors the Democrats, or is the kind of populist authoritarianism that he's rolling out with deportation at the forefront something that could actually build a genuine majority support?
Well, I first of all think that I love listening to this because I think they're certainly differing opinions and they're often well grounded. My read of the election is that while there was a lot more concern about immigration and particularly the border crisis, that the fundamental issue for many people was just a sense that the economy wasn't performing well for them, and inflation was the most important of those issues. And so for a lot of those folks, they would like to see a kind of more effective, efficient, and on inflation, government that has the capacity to kind of make their lives better. And so I think that if there were, I don't have any doubt that there are immigration enforcement actions, even pretty prominent ones, that wouldn't trigger backlash. But I think as May's opening discussion suggested, the kind of scale of resources and disruption that would be required to do something on a large, on a much, larger, grander, size, the scale would I think be highly unpopular and unpopular among a lot of the people who are at the kind of the swing in the American electorate. So, I mean, it is worth remembering that Donald Trump didn't really expand his own base of support dramatically in this election. What happened is that there was a lot of folks who did not ch turn up in Metro America, a lot of Democrats. And those folks, may well be mobilized going forward. And that's certainly what happened back in 2022, in the midterm election, and then in 2018 in the midterm election. So the other things that I think could mobilize people are a general sense that of kind of disarray and chaos. And that seems to come with the Trump and the kind of budget fights that I was talking about, which remember, we don't know yet whether or not the Republicans are going to learn the lesson of 2017 and stay away from healthcare. Some of the budget offsets, as they call them, that have been floated involve massive cuts in Medicaid, the Medicaid program, for example. So, there's no reason to think that people's fundamental views on those have changed. since back then. So the challenge is, as I alluded to, is that the Democrats face a sort of really serious structural barriers. They are concentrated in more densely populated places, and they're concentrated in more populous states. And because they've lost some of these incumbents who've kind of held on in rural places for a long time in this last election, they're just going to have a very hard time winning back the Senate. And remember, like, this is a very weird feature of the American political system, and it means that Republicans have fairly consistently had Senate majorities without representing a majority of the American people, right? So that I just want to emphasize that. But I think on the House is just so close. There's every reason to think that it's going to be in play. And if there's a lot of dissatisfaction, it could quite easily shift. So I will say just one last thing, which I think overarches, you know, everything that we've been saying today, which is that we're entering fairly uncharted waters here. We have not had a president like this, and we've not had, as people have been talking about, a kind of moment of democratic backsliding like this, where people, where lots of very powerful people, including some that we once thought were sort of aligned with the Democratic Party, have shown enormous deference to this incoming administration, right? Media is going to be very afraid, including places like the New York Times are going to be afraid to be too confrontational with Donald Trump. And so there's going to be a dynamic that I think that we see in Democratic backsliding contexts that could make it hard to hold President Trump and the Republican Party accountable. But I still think that that's a very real possibility, and that there's no way that any politician can repeal the laws of political gravity, even if they can tilt the playing field in their favor, to mix metaphors. So it is kind of a question of, like, how much will the normal mechanisms of accountability kick in a context in which we're seeing an erosion of some of the democratic account. The mechanisms, some of the sources of democratic accountability in our system. I don't know how that'll play out, but I think all of us should be engaged and care a lot about that.
Well, I think can I just add something there? I think that's a really, really important point. And the controversial claim I want to suggest is that I don't think the policies are going to really matter, and whether they succeed or fail. I think this is a movement that has widespread support, and it's developed in a context where the notion of information is problematic. And suppose Dodge, for instance, really doesn't achieve any efficiencies, and has only cuts, say, to all the people responsible for diversity issues in their departments. So it'll be a very small slice to the government. That will be spun in various ways, and critiques of it will be challenged. It's going to be very, very difficult in that context, I think, to assess success or failure, and to worry about how the institutions how the policies are feeding into people. Now, despite the multiple hardships, that will probably happen. So in that sense, I think Jacob is exactly right about a new era. And a new sorts of issues. I mean, I think the decision, I don't know how much coverage it got there, but in Europe, the decision by Apple about fact-checking has really shaken the principles of democracy, I think, and worried people in a very profound way. It seems such a bold statement in this context.
Can I jump in here with yeah. I think, one constraint that I think that's a good point. I agree with that. Some of his policies are going to result in economic problems. Mass deportations, you lose a big part of the workforce, aside from the, you know, human side of it. You know, food prices could go up. You won't be able to build any houses. You know, these will affect people in ways that they care about. If he's going to impose tariffs the way he's talking about, that is going to raise prices. So some of the big claims that he's making that he wants to do is going to run into trouble. And if I think Jacob is right, in the last election, people were voting for what they thought was their economic interest. If you see a rise in prices from tariffs and from deporting immigrants, that might have some negative effect. That might have some backlash.
Great. Tom Etzel, I want to ask a question that's been posed by one of our viewers. He said the elephant in the room is climate change. We're talking at a time when California's and LA are burning. And just a few months after the Southeast Coast was hammered by hurricanes, what should we expect over the
Well, the
next
hottest day of the hottest year on record has just passed.
year? Yeah. What should we expect in terms of climate change over the next 4 years? Is it going to be just a caving in to energy interests and a closing down of the scientific capacities of the US government?
I don't know about 4 years, but in the immediate future, it certainly looks like the anti-climate change forces are in command, and Trump's clearly saying that he is drill baby drill. It's his moment to basically reject the green energy, rejecting electric car support. He's going to go after all the tax breaks that encourage more fuel efficient and other means of reducing carbon in the atmosphere. For the moment, I think it's going to be a tough situation for those who believe that climate change is a serious problem, and it's as exemplified by the fires in California and by what happened in North Carolina with the hurricane. Let me just add a second point, though. I think that the last election was more significant, was may well turn out to be more significant than people on the left think, that there may have been a more serious repudiation of liberalism and the tenets of liberalism than people fully recognize. The opposition to incumbency is a global phenomena, and it's been focused primarily more than most of the focus has been on left center governments. The future for the Democratic Party, I think, is well, the best that they right now can hope for is for Trump to screw up and to alienate people, and then they win because Trump screws up. I don't see the Democratic Party having an appeal that on its own brings back a coalition of voters who support the Democratic agenda. The Democrats now have, I think, a substantial problem in that they don't have an identity that appeals across the board. And if they're going to counter the obligation of basically countering authoritarianism has fallen onto the Democratic Party, and I don't think it's well equipped to take on this obligation. I think that's a serious issue looking forward in politics.
Nadia, can I just come back to you for one of the to build on one of your points, which is the international dimensions to this, particularly Europe, since May and I are both in Europe this evening. I do see this election as part of a long march of a nationalist populist right in many countries. Aside from doing damage within the European Union, which I think you're exactly right about, we have a war in Europe at the moment. I mean, people talk about the threat of a war, but we actually have one. And we had a promise today that he's not going to be involved in wars. He's not going to deploy troops, except in Panama, maybe. But how do you see this election in terms of that international? Do you think does he feel stronger to go against some traditional allies?
Well, this is an excellent point. So let's say briefly that Europe Well, Europe, the public opinions in many European countries, several European countries, have been very dubious or uncertain on where to side with or against. So for instance, of course, everybody would agree that Russia invaded Ukraine, but not everybody would agree that we have to be involved in a war. So that how to help Ukraine, and whether it's possible to have instead of sending army like Biden did, to try to have instead the condition for coming to a peace agreement, or simply to start the conversation for the peace agreement, which was impossible since the beginning. So many in the left, and equally in the right for opposite reasons, they attribute to Biden a responsibility in involving too much, to be involved too much in this war. So for this reason, they hope that with Trump, this situation can change, at least because Trump seemed to be less interested in being directly involved in this war. So, which doesn't mean that the war is going to be over. It means that the Russian can win more easily now than it could have won before. So, and the position of many European now right-wing countries in favor, it's not they are in favor of Putin, but they see in Putin not an enemy as they used to see Russia before with the Soviet Union involved. So this is very complex, I would say, in Europe. It is difficult to say that one way or another one, but certainly Ukraine is not an object of such a supportive Europe. It's not like the from the United States. You have the impression that everybody is in favor of Ukraine, not in Europe, and not for because of reason of justice, but because of reason of opportunity. Europe suffered a lot with this war concerning energy. Europe doesn't have an autonomous system of energy, needs to rely either upon Russia or upon US or other countries. So it is, and German economy is really in a bad shape now because it insisted on producing manufacturers which today are either too expensive or outside of the climate change implications that, for instance, the question of automobile industries is old, doesn't have advanced hybridism like from China. So we all this know with this situation. In addition to that, Trump is seen, and for this reason, many people from the left are not necessarily anti-Trump as people from the center Democrats are, because Trump also promised not to have such an attention on NATO. And he asked for European nations to give more money to NATO, which means for many of them that they didn't like very much NATO to begin with in the past, is a moment for the European states or European nations to take care of themselves. And this, for many right-wing movements and also government, is not bad to put money in the army, because it's a way also of facing the question of economic crisis. And as you know, after World War I, the solution to the economic crisis was to put money in the constructions of tanks and armies and weaponry. So this is thus the complexity in which, in my view, Trump can put Europe. Europe is more on itself and more incapable of finding a way that is more democratic and not less instead. So I don't know whether I was able to express this
No,
situation.
that's very good. Thank you so much. And I want to, we've run out of time, so I want to thank our panel, Tom Edsel from the New York Times, Nadia Urbanati from Columbia University, Jacob Hacker from Yale, and Mei Nye from Columbia. And I want to just let you know that if you're found this program interesting, it will be posted as a podcast in a day or two. It'll be available on many of the different streaming sites that exist. And I want to thank everybody who's tuned in today. for joining us. Last word for my colleague, Desmond King.
Just to reiterate my thanks to the panelists for really valuable, stimulating responses to questions which we are only beginning to ponder, or at least the answers to which we're only beginning to get grips with. And I hope we will meet again in maybe 100 days or a year to review where we have got to. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
Thank you. Have a
Bye.
good day. Bye.